Well, the Vatican and the Jewish people have not had the greatest history. Now the Vatican says they're going to recognize a Palestinian state.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, people were asking me yesterday on Facebook, emailing me, are you going to be addressing this on the broadcast? The answer is yes. Vatican recognizes the state of Palestine in new treaty. The Vatican officially recognized the state of Palestine in a new treaty finalized Wednesday, immediately sparking Israeli ire and accusations that the move hurts peace prospects. Michael Brown, thank you for joining us today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. So as always, if you have a Jewish-related call, Jewish-related comment, Hebrew kind of question, Messianic prophecy kind of question or issue, or something to do with the modern state of Israel, even Islam, give us a call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I'll be weighing in on some things happening in the society today that pertain to Israel and the Jewish people. I'll be weighing in on some interesting modes of Jewish interpretation of Scripture. Just had some things in mind. And of course, taking your calls, 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, but before we go any further, I don't know that I've ever played a soundbite this early in the show. Joey, grab clip number 3. Now, it's going to be in Arabic. It's going to be in Arabic. But I want to see if you can make out any of the words, all right? So clip number 3, again, it's in Arabic, but listen to see if you can make out any of the words.
Twitter, Yahudi. Facebook, Yahudi. Instagram, Yahudi. Snapchat, Yahudi.
Did you hear that? Did you hear Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat? This was a Saudi preacher, Saudi Arabian Islamist preacher, May 3rd of this year. So just, 11 days ago. The Jews poison the Muslim hearts and minds with WhatsApp, Twitter, and Facebook. In an address posted on the internet on May 3rd, Saudi Islamist preacher Abdullah Banima, sometimes spelled Banima, said that the Jews put poison into things that the Muslims like. According to him, WhatsApp, Twitter, and Facebook are tools used by the Jews. Mark Zuckerberg, get these other Jews. See, it's a Jewish conspiracy. The reason that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these other online apps and services exist is so that Jews can poison the minds of Muslims. It's a Jewish conspiracy. And you're hearing it here on The Line of Fire, but let's keep it quiet, okay? He continues, our women's honor has been violated as a result of social networks. I wouldn't doubt that. Wouldn't doubt that at all, but to say it's a Jewish conspiracy, yeah. He added that WhatsApp is the sewage that flows in your heart. Despite his criticism of social networks, Banima runs very active Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts. Sadly, he was paralyzed in a swimming pool accident some time back. Anyway, I mean, this is a serious message, and this is what people actually believe. It's the Jews. Something's wrong in society. It's the Jews. They're everywhere. They're taking over. And it's a conspiracy to destroy the world. And if you believe that, my name is Mickey Mouse, not Michael Brown. Anyway, got a lot to cover today, but thought you'd probably hear that first on The Line of Fire. You can actually get more on that message from the Saudi preacher by going to Memri TV, M-E-M-R-I, memritv.org. We've got Jewish-related questions. The phone lines are open, 866-348-7884.
Go!
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The Vatican is recognizing the state of Palestine.
Formal recognition of Palestine is a significant step.
This official recognition of the state of Palestine is seen as a significant step.
The treaty is the first legal document negotiated between the Vatican and the Palestinian state.
All right, so what does this all mean? What should we make of it? 866-34-TRUTH, Michael Brown. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on the Line of Fire. If you've got a thoroughly Jewish-related question, I'll do my best to give you a thoroughly Jewish answer. So, Associated Press reported yesterday that the Vatican officially recognized the state of Palestine in a new treaty finalized Wednesday. Now, remember, in the Middle Ages, at certain times in world history, the Vatican really was like its own state, like almost like its own country with its own army and so on. Now you just think of the Vatican primarily in religious terms and somewhat political terms, but primarily religious terms. There's much more intertwining of things then. But in any case, the Vatican still operates as if it is a political entity, as if it is a social entity, as if it were a country in that respect. Not the same way as all of the countries operate, but obviously, if it was just a religious entity, it's a religious entity alone, it can't make some type of treaty with other states. But the Vatican, this is how it operates. The treaty, which concerns the activities of the Catholic Church in Palestinian territory, makes clear that the Holy See, the Pope, has switched its diplomatic recognition from the Palestinian Liberation Organization to the State of Palestine. So the Holy See, the papal office. The Vatican had welcomed the decision by the UN General Assembly in 2012 to recognize a Palestinian state, but the treaty is the first legal document negotiated between the Holy See and the Palestinian state and constitutes official diplomatic recognition. Yes, it's a recognition that the state exists, said the Vatican spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi. The Israel Foreign Ministry said it was, quote, disappointed, quote, this move does not promote the peace process and distances the Palestinian leadership from returning to direct and bilateral negotiations. Now, theoretically, you could say the Vatican is saying we stand for justice. The Vatican is saying we care about the mistreatment of the Palestinians at the hands of the so-called Israeli occupation. And because we are Christian and we care about the oppressed and the hurting, the way that we can address this injustice is by recognizing a Palestinian state. The problem is, number one, the only way that there can be an official Palestinian state is not by some outside decree, but by diplomatic relations between Israel and the Palestinians. And on a daily basis, the Palestinian people are incited against Israel. In the educational curriculum, in the media, Palestinian TV, and other means, there is constant incitement against Israel and the Jewish people. And this is anything but the way to work towards peace and real partnership. The more that you fuel the Palestinian fire, the more that you say, well, we recognize their statehood, the further they get from really feeling they need to work with Israel. It's almost like if a kid can't get what they want from mommy, they go to daddy. And if they can't get it from daddy and the grandparents around, they go to the grandparents. Anything they can do to bypass the legitimate process, Palestinians might say, well, there is no process. Our demands are rejected at every point. The Israelis would say, we've been willing to concede over and over and over again, and it's never enough. The bigger question is there viability in a two-state solution? Will it genuinely work? Or is it just another step towards having a hostile neighbor of Israel and potentially hostile neighbor on both sides in terms of east and west? We already have north, south to a certain level, but now east, west, even more so, north, east, south, west with Gaza and with the Palestinian state. How is that going to play out for Israel. What is that actually going to mean? And isn't the biggest problem of all, the Palestinian leadership? Not Israel, but the Palestinian leadership. Doesn't it remain true? I hate to repeat this over again, but doesn't it remain true that if the Palestinians were to put down their weapons, there would be no more war between Israel and the Palestinians? If the Israelis were to put down their weapons, there would be no more Israel. That remains the reality. And isn't the Vatican concerned at all about historic anti-Semitism, historic Jew hatred in the church, persecution of Jewish people by the Catholic Church? Yes, it's happened by the Protestant Church as well, but it's happened quite prominently and is engraved in the Jewish psyche. When you think of Christianity, you immediately think of Catholicism and you immediately think of the Crusades and the Inquisitions, and you think that's what, quote, Christianity is. Isn't there a concern on the part of the Vatican to say, hey, we do not want to alienate the Jewish people? And if we recognize a Palestinian state, which really does not do anything to bring about the reality of a Palestinian state, that if we do that, we will unnecessarily hurt and offend Jewish people, where we still try to rebuild trust and we still try to build a relationship. And the current pope has done a better job on this than the previous pope. Isn't that a major concern? Isn't that a good way to undo the history of anti-Semitism that's often existed in the Catholic Church, with many questions in terms of leading up to the Holocaust as well, and what the Catholic Church was and was not doing? Listen to Hanana Shraoui. She was a former spokesperson for PLO, Palestinian Authority. This is clip number 5. Her take on the Vatican's pronouncement that they will recognize a Palestinian state. This is what Hanana Shraoui has to say.
We are indeed extremely encouraged by the Vatican's recognition of the state of Palestine. We also see this as a very positive development, not just politically, but in moral terms, in human terms, in legal terms, and it prepares for a whole new era in which Palestine will be seen by the whole world as a state.
Yeah, well, obviously, I would imagine she would be excited about this and positive about this. Mahmoud Abbas's senior aide, Nabil Shad, said, "This is a very important recognition, as the Vatican has a very important political status that stems from its spiritual status. We expect more EU countries to follow." During Pope Francis's 2000 visit to the Holy Land, Associated Press reminds us, the Vatican's official program referred to Abbas as the president of, quote, the state of Palestine. On the one hand, the Vatican office is trying to downplay the significance of this, but obviously it is major. As the article notes, most countries in Asia, Africa, and South America have individually recognized Palestine. In Western Europe, Sweden took the step last year, while several parliaments have approved non-binding motions urging recognition. You can only imagine on the Israeli side, this is just another insult and another provocation. And once more, the issue comes down to the Islamic leadership. Let's remember that in Gaza, the percentage of Christians is very, very tiny. In so-called West Bank, it is, what, 2, 3% maybe of a professing Christian in their midst. It's a tiny, tiny minority. So it's not so much showing solidarity with fellow Christians. It is saying to Muslims that Israel has no right to be there, and further fueling the fires of Islamic hatred of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are there just in purely natural terms, because in a war for survival in 1967, in the Six-Day War, territory was taken in the midst of this war, just like some of American territory was taken during war, just like many other countries expanded territory during war. And this has been strategic for the Jewish people to have more security in this way. But if their neighbors were not trying to kill them, they would not put up the security fence, which is partly a wall, about, what, 3% of it is a wall. They would not have some of the policies they have. There are harsh policies, for sure, And without a doubt, there are Palestinians who are mistreated by Israelis because the Israelis are not perfect. And yes, we can address that from the viewpoint of social justice. I say that we should, by all means. But that being said, let's be realistic. The problem is the Palestinians want to eliminate the Jewish people from the land. Oh, not all Palestinians, but the Palestinian leadership. And whereas there are over 1.5 million Palestinian Arabs who are citizens in Israel with more liberties than any Arabs and Muslims in the Middle East, Mahmoud Abbas says if there's going to be a Palestinian state, it must be free of Jews. Arabs could live in Israel, but no Jews could live in a Palestinian state. What does that tell you? We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire, 866-348-7888. Whoa, hang on one second. Was I almost giving out the wrong number? Did that almost happen and I caught myself? Or did I get distracted looking at something on the computer? You'll never know. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Aaron in Burke, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. The Vatican has always recognized Palestine or Palestina. And one of their pride gems of the Vatican is the Arch of Titus, which celebrates the destruction of the Jewish people and of Jerusalem. So it shouldn't be surprising. They've been anti-Israel in place of Israel. They've said that the church is in place of Israel. The Pope is in place of Christ, Antichrist. So it's not surprising that they're siding with these Arab squatters on the land of Israel.
Yeah, well, in point of fact, Aaron, there have been hostile attitudes towards Jewish people through history. There have been attempts since Vatican II to reach out, different attempts through history, but more attempts in recent years to reach out in a conciliatory way. Obviously, post-Holocaust theology had to factor some of these things in, a previous pope embracing Yasser Arafat, things like that. Yes, they have happened historically. This is the first official recognition of a Palestinian state. But has there been hostility between the Catholic Church and the Jewish people? Has there been great Jewish mistrust of the Jewish of the Vatican in the hearts and minds of Jewish people? Yes. And that's why it's more of a disappointment now, because current Pope, Pope Francis, had done better than Pope Benedict in terms of reaching out and in terms of honoring Jewish people and rabbis and things like that, more so than Benedict. So this is really another step backwards. Yeah, but the history is not a good history. Aaron, thank you for calling in. I would not refer to the Palestinians as squatters in the land of Israel. I wouldn't refer to them as squatters. Some have been there for centuries. But the idea that they are the original inhabitants of the land, of course, is completely bogus. In fact, before I go on to some other things, this was an interview years back by Zola Levitt, the late Zola Levitt, and Hanan Ashrawi, and they're talking about the presence of Palestinians and the presence of Jewish people in the land. Of course, Zola Levitt was a well-known Messianic Jewish author and TV personality. So we'll start with clip number 6. I played these months back or a year or two ago, something. I know I've played them at least once, but they're so representative. I wanted to pull them up and play them again. So clip number 6.
What is the real history of the Palestinian people in this land?
Well, we go back centuries. Actually, if you want, we go back to the Canaanites.
To the Canaanites?
Yes. So the Palestinians are the longest standing, ongoing, historical human tradition in Palestine. Of course, we are also a mix of so many tribes that came into Palestine. But those of us, I mean, my family has been here for centuries. Most people trace their families, you know, centuries and thousands of years.
Centuries and thousands of years. They go back to the Canaanites. First, who in the world would want to trace your lineage back to the Canaanites? I mean, they are kind of the prototypical pagans as far as the way they're depicted in Scripture and would be remembered historically through Scripture. So who in the world would want to trace your lineage back to them? But obviously, well, if you can, then, you know, we were here before the people of Israel. First, there is no connection that can be made in any clear and substantive way that the Palestinians today go back to the Canaanites who lived in the land before the Israelite conquest in the mid to late second millennium BC. So somewhere between the 15th and 13th centuries BC, depending on the dating that is used. And that's a whole other subject, the date of the Exodus and then the conquest of Canaan. What we do know is that there was never an Arab state called Palestine, that Palestinian identity was never a strong part of the people who lived there. They saw themselves as part of Greater Syria. That was part of their identity. I mean, this is fairly well known. Walid Shubat has famously said that he was a Jordanian one day and then woke up the next day, this after the Six-Day War, and then he was a Palestinian. Now there was a new identity that was being embraced. And what we also know is that there were many, many different peoples living in the land, always a Jewish presence, and only the Jewish people were considering Jerusalem their capital and Palestine, Israel, their homeland, and longing to be back there every year. So yeah, there were people that lived there for decades, some for centuries, but the amount of those who lived there for centuries is minuscule. You're not talking about millions of people or even hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who lived there for centuries. You're not. We know that the population grew, that in the late 1800s, the Arab population began to grow as Jewish settlers came in and began to develop the land and it had more value. Then Arab settlers increased. And for the most part, they were living side by side peacefully. But there was no notion that this is a Palestinian state. There was no such concept any more than when the first Americans came here, or excuse me, that's, I said it the opposite of the way I wanted. When the first settlers came here to America, that they were patriotic Americans praising the United States of America. There was no such thing as the United States of America when the first settlers came over here from Europe. So the point is, there was no Palestinian state, Palestinian identity. There was no Palestinian flag, no official Palestinian government. It was ruled by different groups over different periods of time. And ultimately, the ones that were longing to be back there and praying for it in their daily prayers, and the ones that considered Jerusalem to be their sacred capital, those were the Jewish people. So yes, we need to be fair and compassionate towards the Palestinians, the Arabs who lived there for decades or even for some centuries, but let us not misrepresent the facts. Friends, be sure to check out this week's special resource offer by going to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, and just clicking right on the homepage, there's a video that will give you more information when you do. And if you can join us, your one-time gift or monthly support means the world to us, helps us do exactly what we're doing as we are your listener-sponsored arm of outreach to the lost sheep of the House of Israel. 866-34-TRUTH. I'll be taking calls another hour and a half. Join in however you can.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. PalWatch.org. If you've never visited there, I encourage you to. PalWatch. PalWatch.org, as in Palestinian Watch. Reporting on what is being played on Palestinian media. What is being played for children in Gaza. What is being played on Palestinian Authority TV in the Palestinian territories. Here is March 25th this year. This is a boy on PATV. The goal is to boycott Israeli products and fight the Jews, kill them. So this is the PATV reporter, and this is official Palestinian Authority TV. Instilling the culture of boycotting occupation products in the hearts of children and adolescents was the goal that led the PA Ministry of Education to place this issue at the center of all school activities throughout the homeland. Through creative activities, students expressed different views about support for national products and resistance through boycott. And there's a boy participating in a theater contest at a school in Hebron. I came to rehearse the play in order to boycott Israeli products and fight the Jews, kill them, and defeat them. The goal is to boycott Israeli products. These are kids, all right? These are children who are being indoctrinated by Palestinian Authority TV. And obviously, this only adds salt, pours salt into whatever wounds already exist. 866-348-7884. Let's go to Frederick in Lanham, Maryland. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
Thank you for everything you do. Yeah, actually, I got to meet you when you came to Silver Spring a couple months ago.
And, okay, great.
I was there, and thank you for everything that you're doing. I mean, actually, this problem between the Jews and Palestine, I think they used to call them they are the Philistines, isn't it?
Yeah, they used to. Okay, here's the deal. The name Palestine came about in the second century when Rome wanted to further degrade the Jewish connection to the land and mock the Jewish people's connection to the land. So they named it after the Philistines and called it Philistia, which then we say is Palestine. But there's no connection, of course, to the Philistines. They had ceased to exist as a viable people by that time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is, God gave this land to the Jews, and there is no question about it. And if you, like Christians who are saying they are Christians, and they are talking about all this replacement theology and all this stuff that God, this land belongs to the Philistines, if you believe in the true God, he gave this land to the Jews. He gave it to them. And matter of fact, the land that he gave them, the Jews are not able to occupy the whole land. Because the reason why I'm feeling so bad for the Jews is all because of disobedience. And if they should have done what God told them to do, to get rid of these people, avoid intermarriages, get them out of the land completely, you should not have been in this position where we are in today. Because of they failed to obey the word of God, that is why all this confusion. Because any leader who knows that God is the true God, he gave this land to them. The Jews did not just come and grab this land. It was given to them by the true God. And all these things is a spiritual battle. Satan is behind all this. And up to now, we see what is happening behind. Of course, the Catholic Church, they've been compromising from day one. They're just an adulterous church. They've just been doing things that are very, very disastrous to the name of Christ. But anyway, we know that this land belongs to the Jews, and God gave it to them. So 100%, I believe it is the land of the Jews. And it has nothing to do with illegal occupation. The Jews doesn't occupy the land illegally. It was given to them by the Creator. And God says, the whole land, the whole world is his. He gives to whoever he chooses to give it to. So he gave them this land because he chose to. So whoever is fighting against the Jews is fighting against God himself.
That's all right, hey, Frederick, we got the music playing. That means we're out of time. But thank you for weighing in. Many Christians would see it the same way. Hey, this is something ordained by God. Yes, treat everyone with justice. But this is something that God has done.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That music tells you what. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I was sent a note by a friend this morning. A quote from the author of Heather Has Two Mommies, one of the famous pioneer gay activist books for children. And the author, Leslie Newman, herself Jewish. So this interesting story, she's reflecting back. She said people were scared to publish Heather. This is 1989, so she self-published, even though there was a need for it. No one would touch it, but we were fierce Jewish women. Well, hang on one second. I self-published A Queer Thing Happened to America because people were afraid to touch the book and have since had three publishers apologize to me. They were afraid to touch it, so I get discredited and mocked in gay activist circles. No one would publish this book. You had to self-publish. Isn't that interesting? Here is a book self-published, Heather Has Two Mommies, because people were afraid to touch it. Interesting perspective difference, isn't there? Then within a year, it was picked up by Allison Publications. So it's 25 years the book has been out. She said it occurs when gay marriage is legal in 37 states, and Heather Has Two Mommies is a catchphrase that has entered the popular culture. She says, when I was growing up, women were not allowed on the Bima, which is the platform in the synagogue. It would be similar to in a church building if you have up front with a pulpit, and that's some steps up. So the Bima would be similar, and that's also where you have the Torah, the scroll of the five books of Moses and other sacred writings that would be there. She said, when I was growing up, women were not allowed on the Bima. She said, now you can have two moms on the Bima. Well, not in an Orthodox shul, not in an Orthodox synagogue. Obviously in a Reform synagogue, in a very liberal synagogue. But in an Orthodox synagogue, no way, no how. And the men and the women are going to be separated, period. Let alone have women up where the Torah scroll is being read by the men, let alone have lesbian moms up there. All that shows is one tradition has gone further and further away from Scripture and Judaism, and the other has held with Scripture and Jewish tradition, or at the least Jewish tradition. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Peterborough, Ontario. Ron, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thanks, Dr. Brown.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. I want to relate an experience that I had last week, Dr. Brown, and then I'm going to basically ask you a question after, okay?
Yep.
All right. A pastor friend of mine invited me to his church. Guest speaker wanted me to hear a guest speaker. Halfway through the message, he was talking about Abraham negotiating with God regarding the 50, trying to save Sodom. And then he used an expression that I think you and I have heard a few times called Jew you down. Abraham started to try to Jew God down.
Right.
He laughed. Pastor laughed. Congregation laughed. I turned 5 shades of red and walked out. Called the pastor the next day and said, you know, I was totally insulted by what the guest speaker said. I was also insulted by the reaction of the congregation. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was an insult to God and his people. And at this point in time, I'm not sure exactly where I stand with this, with these people or with this fellow. But my general question is, based on that experience, what do you think, okay, let me rephrase this correctly. What's the general state of anti-Semitism in the body of the church today, in your opinion?
Well, right. If you're talking about believers in America or believers in Canada, you know, you're talking about tens of millions of people with all kinds of diversity, and there is no one answer to that. To me, this is just an area of insensitivity, what you witnessed there. In other words, that, you know, it's just an expression that's being used. And maybe they know Jewish business people and the the Jewish business people they know are pretty tough negotiators and things like that. Look, I've dealt with different ethnicities over the years, and when I was in sales many years ago, and there were certain groups that, as a group, they were stingier, and then others, as a group, they were easier to deal with. So, you know, the generalities can happen, but when someone uses it from the outside, it is offensive. When someone uses it from the outside, it can be hurtful. So I understand how you'd feel about that, and the people's laughter, how that would be. Again, sometimes it's just a cultural insensitivity. It's not any type of serious anti-Semitism. But in the circles in which I travel, there tends to be great love for the Jewish people, esteem for Jewish people, that if a rabbi came in and was going to give a talk, you know, Rabbi Daniel Lapin or my friend Rabbi Shmuley, that people would be honored because they have great respect for rabbis, even though they're praying for them to come to know Jesus as the Messiah. But certainly, you have pockets where there is real hostility towards Israel and the Jewish people. I'm surprised on a regular basis, Ron, to run into really ugly, profane, anti-Israel, anti-Jewish statements. I mean, ugly stuff. I mean, stuff that immediately we block the people from being able to comment on our sites. And yes, yeah, some are from Muslims, maybe from Pakistan or somewhere else, that are going to have a very skewed view on Israel and the Jewish people. But others are from professing Christians. To me, though, that's the minority. I do feel there is a rising tide of anti-Israel sentiment. It's still overwhelmed by pro-Israel sentiments in the body. But there's a rising tide. In Canada, the best thing I think you have going for you in that regard is a very strong pro-Israel prime minister, uniquely, with a very, very clear and articulate voice on these issues. That really helps. The older generation, though, they seem to have more of an understanding of the importance of the state of Israel and of what God has done to bring the Jewish people back to the land. The younger generation has much more of a blind spot there, and that's where we really have to pray and be concerned. Hey, Ron, thank you for the call. I do appreciate it, and may the Lord's grace be yours in a very deep and serious level. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Bozeman, Montana. Bruce, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown, for taking my call. I just had a question. I don't know if you're, I'm assuming you are aware of it, but I understand your views on whether or not Torah, Sabbath, the feast, those things are required for believers in Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I disagree, but I accept your view. But my question to you is, are you aware of certain, well, pastors / teachers on the internet especially, and of course I'm sure there's people that we haven't even heard, that when you talk to them about, you know, someone being in the Hebrew roots or Messianic movement, take things a step further and call those who do follow those things,
mm-hmm.
Heretics, et cetera, et cetera. And
yep.
Even, you know, I've seen videos where, you know, they say, oh, the Hebrew roots movement is the demon roots movement,
and mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. And I'm just wondering what your view and what your response is, and what do you think somebody's response who is involved in
yeah.
Messianic Judaism should be towards those people.
Yeah, see, what happened is you group together Messianic Judaism with Hebrew roots, and often they're two totally different things. There are people in the Hebrew roots movement who are outright heretics. They are sectarians. They are completely divisive. They no longer preach a message of salvation by grace. Some of them get caught up in sacred name type stuff, and they should not be dealt with as believers in any way. And others are, say, in the Messianic Jewish movement, of which I'm a part, are fine believers, thoroughly committed to preaching the gospel, living by grace, but feeling as Jews that God wants them to live in solidarity with their people, and to that the law is now written on their heart, and therefore they follow it. And they welcome Gentile believers in their midst, not in an obligatory way, but simply welcoming them in their midst to celebrate the biblical calendar with them. Great. Wonderful. I'm all for it. Go for it. The Hebrew Roots Movement, though, is often separate. Look, I spoke at a congregation unknowingly a few weeks ago led by Pastor Jim Staley that's associated with the Hebrew Roots Movement. I thought it was a Messianic congregation when I was going there, only found out it was his congregation afterwards, but he's associated with the Hebrew Roots Movement. He told me and said, I can quote him, that he's completely left the Hebrew Roots Movement and he renounces it. So here's right. Here's someone that was considered to be a leader within it and said that he renounces it. So it's all definition, Bruce. But stay right there. I want to talk to you another minute about this. It's all definition.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Senator Ted Cruz tweeted this out 12 minutes ago, 67 years ago. The state of Israel declared her independence. 11 minutes later, America recognized this great event. Sorry it took us so long. 866-34-TRUTH. So, Bruce, just back to you. There are teachings I've seen by Hebrew Roots people that are absolutely heretical, that deny fundamentals of the faith, or that are so schismatic, and so our way is the only way, and get caught up with all kinds of other issues that I would not associate with them in any way as brothers or sisters. And I see some of the most idiotic comments coming in about you have to say Yeshua, which is a non-existent name, or you know they get all these weird ideas about the names of God, and they're going to major on that, and that everyone is in disobedience and sin unless they're keeping all the commandments. That's dangerous. That's unbiblical. And in that respect, it's the very type of message that should be resisted and exposed. The message of the Messianic Jewish congregations is very different than that. You may have some that are fringe, but I'm talking about the mainstream of the movement is very different than that.
Right. And I'm sorry, I think, and it's probably my fault that I didn't phrase the question right, but I think you misunderstood my point. I understand and agree with everything you've said on that. My question was actually for those pastors/teachers who, without making that distinction between Messianic Judaism and Hebrew Roots, would say about both, okay, that if, you know, regardless of whether one would say it's required of everybody, but just say in your own practice, in your own faith, that if you were doing any of those things, if as a Messianic Jew or even as a Gentile, if you on your own decided you wanted to keep the Sabbath, okay?
Yeah, so people are reacting in ignorance. That's what
right,
it is.
They're afraid that crucifying Christ again to yourself if you do those things, you know.
Right, right. So it's based on ignorance. Yeah. It's based on ignorance, and it's just the way that the church has lived for centuries and has departed so far from Jewish roots that when people return to where the apostles would have lived or Jewish believers lived in the first centuries, that it seems completely strange and odd to them. Thankfully, more and more are recognizing the validity of it. More and more leading Christian scholars are saying, hey, God never changed the Sabbath to Sunday, and there's no mandatory keep the Sabbath on Sunday commandment in the New Testament. This is a matter of church tradition. So there's more and more recognition of these things, Bruce. But look, there are too many people that bring a bad name. There are too many people that are confused in this and teach in confusing ways and are schismatic, and that only makes it easier for others to react. That only makes it easier for others to dismiss the whole thing. But obviously, any believer is free. Gentile believer is free to keep a seventh-day Sabbath. Gentile believer is free to celebrate the Passover. But if they do it, they need to celebrate it in the context of Yeshua being the fulfillment of it. Hey, thank you for the call. We'll go to Vesper, somewhere in New Jersey. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm really happy to be on. I've been meaning to call you for a while about this, actually. So I'm sitting here working on a master's illustration project about post-Holocaust Germany, and it's made me ask some more questions about my own background and Jewish roots.
Mm-hmm.
So I was raised in New York City in a Reform Jewish home. I'm not Jewish by blood, but by my mother's conversion. And but I've always identified myself as a Christian of Jewish background. So as I'm working on this project, it's making me ask a lot of questions about what is my standing, okay, as a person of Jewish background. So I seem to have kind of three strikes against me, not being Jewish by birth, having my mother's conversion be considered by some invalid because it's a Reform conversion,
right,
and also being a Christian, you know, a Messianic believer. So I've kind of wondered through my master's project, like, would I ever be, for instance, qualified to make Aliyah? Or, you know, who would consider me to be authentically Jewish?
Right. How old were you when your mother converted?
Four.
Yeah. Okay. I honestly, I'm not sure whether the state of Israel recognizes that. Obviously, if your mother's Jewish, then you can make Aliyah. There can be resistance if you are a professing Christian, so that, you know, Messianic Jews sometimes have had a problem making Aliyah. Many have made it successfully, but some have had a problem when their faith in Jesus became known. And then you are right, because Reformed Jewish conversion is not recognized in Orthodox circles at all. It would have been one thing if she had converted and then you were born after she converted. Then you would have been born technically to a Jewish mother, at least in Reform or conservative circles would have recognized it. And I believe the state of Israel would have recognized it. The fact your mother converted when you were four does bring a cloud over it on a certain level. However, if you were raised understanding that you were Jewish, which I assume is the case, is that right?
It's right, but I didn't become bat mitzvah or anything like that. Although my brother and sister, who are my stepfather's and my mother's kids, they did become bar and bat mitzvah.
And what about your stepfather?
He's Jewish.
Right. So you were raised going to synagogue?
Yeah.
Okay. You were raised going to synagogue, and when you came to faith in Jesus, was your thought, well, the Jews don't believe in Jesus? Did that have to be overcome?
No. I became a Christian at 16, and I actually worked for Jews for Jesus for a time.
Got it. Look, I mean, this is what Israel says. I'm sorry to say that I'm not sure about this, just a slightly different question than we normally get asked on this. Obviously, you can say that you're a Christian or a follower of Jesus with Jewish background. I mean, that's certain. That's unambiguous, and that's not misleading at all. But really, it's between you and God, because you were raised as if you were Jewish, right? I mean, nothing magical would have happened in your blood if your mother converted before you were born, right, and had married your stepfather, you know, somewhere along the line. But if you were raised Jewish and were conscious of being a Jew as you grew up, if kids said to you, I'm Catholic, oh, I'm Muslim, I'm Jewish, then that's how you were raised. That was your self-understanding. Your mother had converted. Your stepfather was Jewish. I think you could legitimately say that of yourself if that was really part of your identity. Now, whether the rabbinic community recognizes that or not, some would, some wouldn't. But of course, what we do know is that our life and our spirituality and our ultimate identity is found in Jesus as being sons and daughters of God. Hey, out of time, but hopefully what I said can be of value to you. It's ultimately a matter of self-consciousness between you and God. The Aliyah question is separate. All right, remember, friends, check out my latest article on the Line of Fire. Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. While you're there, click on the special resource offer this week to find out about an exciting class we have available for you. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and I've got something to say to anti-Semites today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, thanks for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 67 years ago, the State of Israel born. And tomorrow is the day that Palestinians will recognize as Al-Nakba. Al-Nakba. Yeah, Joey, you're right. No bottom line. I left out my bottom line. That's what, maybe three times? I left out the bottom line. Guilty as charged. Wow. Wow. Can you imagine all my listeners from the last hour? They're like, Dr. Brown, there is no bottom line. Someone's going to come home today, come home from work, come home from picking up kids at school, listening on your computer, and you just, his life is just not right. Mike didn't give us the bottom line today. I apologize. Oh, boy. All right, do we do two bottom lines at the end of this hour here? Oh, can't believe I did, but I did it. I did it. All right. I don't want to beat myself up because I got to be upbeat. To go forward now on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, Michael Brown, thanks for joining us. 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question you have, Hebrew-related question, something to do with Jewish tradition, background, modern state of Israel, we'll talk about it today. 866-34-TRUTH. Okay. So tomorrow Palestinians will commemorate what is called Al-Nakba, the disaster, the catastrophe, namely the Palestinian view of the founding of Israel. And there's an article that came out yesterday on camera.org. CAMRA is the Committee for Accuracy in Middle Eastern Reporting in America, CAMRA. And it says, what you won't hear about Nakba Day, one, over 800,000 Jews either fled or were driven out of their homes in Arab countries during and after Israel's war for independence. This is roughly equivalent to or even greater than the number of Palestinian Arab refugees created by that war. It's actually greater than. Israel absorbed the Jews who immigrated there, but the Palestinian refugees have been kept in camps for decades, used by Arab leaders as a cudgel to batter Israel. True. It's true. Number two, there is no such thing as a Palestinian right of return. Those who claim there is such a right often cite as its basis UN Resolution 194 passed on December 11, 1948. This is a General Assembly resolution, therefore does not carry the weight of international law. Further, the Arab states voted against 194 precisely because it did not create a right of return and have violated numerous times since its passage. Number three, to date, Palestinian Arab leaders do not accept Israel's right to exist. The terrorist group Hamas, which rules the Gaza Strip, has sworn to the destruction of Israel and the genocide of Jews worldwide. The Hamas charter declares Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam abolishes it. The moderate, in quotes, Fatah movement, headed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, currently in the 10th year of his four-year presidential term, also continues to deny the very existence of the Jewish state. Last month, Fatah posted on its official Facebook page, Palestine means the entire national land from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. The land is for us Palestine. So in other words, where Israel lives, Jewish people live, that's ours. Number four, Palestinian leaders have refused multiple offers of statehood made by various Israeli leaders. And number five, the truth that is not told but is known among many. The failings of Arab leadership are the major stumbling blocks to a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And CAMRA quotes at length Israeli-Arab journalist Khaled Abu Tomeh. Yes, an Israeli-Arab journalist. Whole lot to come today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH.
Thanks.
This is Dr. Michael Brown, host of The Line of Fire. If you haven't been to AskDrBrown.org, what are you waiting for? There are hundreds of free audios, videos, articles to help equip you. And while you're there, check out the benefits of becoming a torchbearer, a monthly supporter of The Line of Fire. This week, we're giving all new torchbearers Let the Lion Roar, DVD, CD, CDs of interviews, and a book, more than a $40 value, all yours as you partner with us as a torchbearer. Together, we're making a difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Can I just talk from my heart for a moment here? Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Of course, you know that's what I'm going to do always. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call to get in the conversation today. Again, on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, we don't take calls on all Bible subjects or all social issues or all matters that we normally talk about on The Line of Fire. We only take calls that relate to Israel, Jewish issues, sometimes Islam as well, Hebrew-related questions, questions about the modern state of Israel, questions about Jewish people and the law, and things like that. So that's what the phones are open for today. If you call with other questions, you'll be directed to other days, 866-348-7884. Okay, I get so fed up, so bothered by this endless drivel about wrong pronunciations of God's name and the Messiah's name. And, on our website, we have blog posts that I've written on these things or sometimes posted articles on them, and they will get certain amounts of comments. And because our sites are very busy between our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, our YouTube channel, and then our website itself. Plus, when I write an article, it might be posted on 5 or 10 or 20 different places. And then sometimes there can be hundreds of comments generated that I don't see a tremendous amount of what is posted. Look, I'd love to see all of it. I'd love to interact with all of it. If I had endless time and could do everything else I needed to do and spend time with God and be in the Word and do the research and writing that I do day and night, and radio and preach and teach and minister and be with family and spend time with my wife and so on, if I had endless time and, you know, in a day was just endless hours, well, then obviously I'd like to interact with everybody. I'd like to take every call every day. I'd like to interact with every person, obviously. And I'd love to set people right that are wrong. I'd love to refute error. I'd love to learn. I'd love to affirm. But I can't do that. But I do see some comments sometimes, and I have to be honest with you. Some of them are such drivel. Some of them are so false, so filled with misinformation, and then in their tone, nasty, and you have to call them idiotic in their insults of others, that I would like to just block certain people from commenting. Now, we do, if they use profanity, they're instantly blocked. If they engage in personal attacks against others, they're blocked. But some, if they're just posting wrong information, unless it's dangerously wrong information, we're not going to block them. But I read some of the stuff. You know, and you just think it's so ignorant, it's so false. And here's the frustration. Here's the frustration. Okay. Here's the frustration. When you communicate truth, look, there are areas where I'm well-studied and areas where I'm not. There are areas where I'm really dogmatic about certain things and areas where I'm not. There are plenty of areas where you can lecture me in your areas of expertise and I would learn and I wouldn't be able to differ with much because I don't know much about it. And then there are areas where I could lecture you and you could learn and you wouldn't be able to differ much because you wouldn't know much about it. There is this pseudo-scholarship that is all over the internet. where people just quote these things that are complete nonsense, non-existent things, but they gain ground. You know, I'll give you an example, not specifically along these lines, but I'll give you an example. The whole idea that Mithraism is an ancient religious cult that predates Christianity and yet has the birth of its savior on December 25th and all these parallels, and this came before Christianity and this is where Christianity got it from. And then you'll search online and say, yeah, there are all these websites that say it. Well, who does it go back to? What are the scholarly books that it goes back to? Where's the peer-reviewed scholarship and journals that this goes back to? For the most part, the vast majority of what you see is internet myth. You know, you used to have urban myth, something just spreads around the city and everybody repeats it. Well, we're talking about some type of internet myth, and that's much more volatile because once it gets out there, it just spreads and spreads and spreads. In point of fact, most all of the traditions that you can point to as, wow, look at this, these are parallels, they come after the Christian centuries. They come after these Christian traditions were developed or these biblical truths were written down. So they come afterwards and now they borrow and then they claim to be earlier. It would be like saying that George Washington was quoting speeches from Ronald Reagan. Well, obviously that didn't happen. But then you're going to come up with this whole thing. No, but you see, George Washington knew this secret source that Ronald Reagan then was going to use, and that's how he's quoting. I mean, it's just completely bogus. We know what came first. We know that George Washington came before Ronald Reagan. We know that. There's no mystery here. Well, the God's name is Yahweh, and therefore you have to have Yah and Yahshua. No, you don't. You don't. You didn't have Yah in the name Yehoshua, which is the longer name Joshua. You didn't have it there. What happened is Yahweh at the beginning of a name would then be reduced. You have what are called apocopated forms and verbs where a final a syllable gets reduced and is dropped out. You'll lose consonants. These things will actually happen. They are commonplace. So when you have accents shift and change, we can trace how words developed. We can trace the history of Hebrew and why an accent is in one place in this word and in another place in another word. You know, I hear people talking about all the time the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. It's not HaKodesh, it's HaKodesh. The accent's on the ko. Well, isn't the accent always on the last syllable? No, in Hebrew it's normally on the last syllable, but absolutely not always. And we know exactly how this word came about, why we say Kodesh for holy, or Kesef for money, or Yeled for boy, or Delet for door. We know why, or Melech for king, and on with many of these words. We know where the pronunciations come from. Kodesh for holy, Chodesh for month. We know how syllables shifted. This is, I've got a PhD in Semitic languages. Some of the classes we had were in the history of the Hebrew language and development of things and how we got this and why it says it this way in Hebrew and this way in Arabic and this way in Aramaic and so on. This is known scientifically through the history of the study of languages. A lot of it is not a mystery. Just like we can see now how a certain word came into English. For example, the word knight, like a knight in shining armor. Why do we have a K there? Do we use that? Do we say knight? Oh, he's a knight in shining armor. Hang on, you've got the GH there. He's a knicht in shining armor. Well, no, we don't say it, but it comes from German where it was pronounced, knecht. Where it was K-N-E-C-H-T, it was pronounced. So hence we get knight in English, but then as the English language develops, some of these letters become silent. And then in some spellings, you know, like color with O-U-R or labor O-U-R that you still have in British English spellings, we don't have. There was obviously pronunciation shifts and then redundant letters disappear. So we know how these things shift. And we know with Yahweh at the beginning of a name would then shift. Yahu at the end, Eliyahu instead of Eliyahweh, my God is Yahweh, becomes Yahu. There's a shortening. And then at the beginning of a word, All right? The beginning of a word would then become Yehoh, as in Yehoshua. And then when that becomes shortened further, you have a form Hoshea, same name, and then Yeshua, same name. None of them have Yah because it's at the beginning of the word, and that's how the shifts occurred. You can say, well, I don't think so. Fine.
Well, you're wrong because you're just relying on your doctrine. You're not a man of the spirit.
Hey, listen, 2 + 2 = 4, whether you're a man of the spirit or a man of the flesh. You realize that? If you give someone $1 and get back 75 cents change, whether you're a man of the spirit or man of the flesh, 75 cents change is 3/4. Yeah. All this, and you just got a lot of this idiocy surrounding Jewish-related issues. Sad to say. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It is thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown here on The Line of Fire. So what's a day like for someone living in Israel? You're living in northern Israel. Well, Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a terrorist group and is funded, supported by Iran. Our friend Iran that's still chanting death to America. Our new partner in peace, Iran. Yes, sarcasm there. Here's a picture. Smoke rises from shells fired from Israel over Al-Wazani area in southern Lebanon. Israeli official made unusually detailed allegations on Wednesday of secret Hezbollah guerrilla sites in Lebanese villages, driving home its warning that civilians there risk bearing the brunt of any future war. Hezbollah has been building up its arsenal since the last inconclusive conflict of 2006, and Israel regards the Iranian-backed Shiite guerrillas as its most immediate threat. Worried that thousands of precision-guided Hezbollah rockets could paralyze their vital infrastructure, Israeli planners have long threatened to launch a blitz against suspected launchers in Lebanon, even if that means harming civilians. You see, here's the challenge. Here's the challenge. As the article states, each of the some 200 Shiite villages in southern Lebanon, quote, is a military stronghold. Even though you can walk in the street and you'll see nothing. What that means is they have embedded within the villages their rocket launchers. We've heard from people that lived in Lebanon that are followers of Jesus today that talked about how they would set up right near, they'd get a Christian neighborhood and set up there to bomb and attack Israel. And if Israel retaliates now, Israel is killing citizens. Israel is killing civilians. That's obviously a terrible situation. An Israeli official said it's a win-win situation for Hezbollah. If we attack them, we kill civilians. If we don't attack because there are civilians, it's good for Hezbollah as well. You know, I was sent this by friends in Israel without attribution. So I'm reading the article as I'm looking at it. It does not have attribution, so I can't tell you where it initially came from. Just some other news from Israel. Israel has been a very, very major presence in Nepal, in the midst of the earthquakes now, another devastating earthquake, not as serious as the last one. The devastating one 2 weeks back killed, what, more than 8,000 people. I mean, just chilling, mind-numbing numbers. But there was a smaller earthquake, took place Tuesday morning, and Israel has a strong presence there in helping in humanitarian work, in helping with caring for those that have been displaced and reaching out to those in need, even sending Israeli clowns to help minister to the children there that were traumatized, and even rebuilding a village and so on. So on the one hand, Israel is always on the front lines of humanitarian work. You'll often see Israelis involved along with Christian relief organizations. Somebody tweeted out this mocking thing yesterday, does God not care about starving children? And I said, of course. I said, there's actually enough food in all the world for everybody if we share it. And then secondly, it's Christian relief organizations, Christian relief ministries that are the first ones there when there are needs. I mean, famously around the world, be it World Vision or Samaritan's Purse or other massive organizations that care for the poor, the needy, the hungry, the hurting around the world. And this gal who had posted the attacking tweet said, what are you talking about? Atheist ministries are there first. I mean, because she was professing atheist, it would have been strange if she was mocking herself there. But yeah, right. We'll just leave it there. Yeah, right. I'm not saying that no atheists do good. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying overwhelmingly, you'll see the relief, even in the Muslim world, is coming from Christian organizations. But there's another reason that Israelis are there. And that reason is that Nepal is a place that many Israelis go on spiritual journeys, looking for God, looking for enlightenment. It's very common for Israelis to go to places like India and Nepal. Now, of course, one Israeli told me, I was in India one time. It was a couple maybe in their 40s, and I was chatting with them, and I asked them in Hebrew. My modern Hebrew is not so good, but you know, I can converse on basic levels. And, you know, I asked them, why do so many Israelis come to India? And they said, it's very cheap. If you're going to go on a spiritual search, might as well go where it doesn't cost that much. But Israelis are there because of many Israeli young people searching for truth. You can go into Nepal, a major city, and find a large Chabad building. Chabad being Orthodox Jewish, Lubavitch is another way that they're referred to. But these are ultra-Orthodox Jews who do outreach to other Jews, and there they are with a large facility trying to reach wandering, seeking Jews in Nepal. And then in that same district in Nepal, there are some solid believers, Jewish believers, working with other Christians there who are reaching out to Jewish seekers as well. So that's one reason for the strong presence. Oh, one other thing about Iran, and then I will come back here to your calls. And I got a little bit of a rant that I want to go off on that I'm going to because it's my show. And I bothered by something else I want to talk to you about as well. But if you were going in for a job interview, what would you be asked for? Would you be asked for a resume? Okay, let's see something about you. Let's see where you've worked. Let's see what positions you've held, how long you've been there, and so on. And we need references. What can people tell us about you? So what's your track record? And what can people tell us about you? When it comes to Iran, what are the references? What are people saying? Well, Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern Muslim countries are skipping an upcoming USA Arab summit at the White House in the Camp David retreat this week. They're skipping it, and one main reason is they're not happy with U.S. policies on Iran. They're not happy with the fact that the USA, in their view, is empowering Iran to get nuclear weapons. And they say they're going to get nuclear weapons. We want nuclear weapons. What's their track record? Well, they fund much of the terror. They say, look, these are surrounding Arab Muslim nations speaking about other Muslims, Iranian Muslims, Farsi, Persian Muslims, and saying we don't trust them. Look at their record in the region. They finance terror. Now, Iran might point right back to Saudi Arabia and say, well, so do you. We're just on different sides. But Iran's track record is not good. The resume is not good. And the personal references from other countries that know them, not good either. All right, friends, make sure to check out this week's special resource offer. You can do so by going to my website, AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org. Right on the homepage, there's a video that will tell you more as well. Also, when you're there, check out latest articles. I wrote a really interesting one, which is why conservative churches are growing. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. Here's a report from earlier today. Steph Cockcroft for Mail Online. BBC under fire. Good reason. BBC under fire. After Home Affairs editor Mark Eastern, quote, compares extremist preacher Anjem Choudhary to Gandhi and Mandela. Wow. He said, I was in Parliament Square today. A statue of Gandhi looking down at me, who was jailed for being extremist. Mandela, who was jailed for being an extremist. History tells us that extreme views are sometimes needed to challenge very established values that people at the time hold so dear. You gotta be kidding me. You're gonna make a comparison between Gandhi and Mandela? And obviously Gandhi was involved in some extremist activities that were more violent than Gandhi. But did either of them mouth the things that Choudhary has mouthed? Did either of them ever say anything that resembled some of the radical Islamic rhetoric of Anjem Choudhary? This is Adam Dean, founder and executive director of the Dean Institute, a Muslim debating forum and think tank. He said the error is that he's assuming that Anjem is arguing the same way or dissenting in the same way as the likes of Mandela or Gandhi, both of whom were dissenting with a backdrop of views that the establishment already held. Unlike Mandela and Gandhi, Choudhary completely rejects those values of democracy and tolerance, which makes the comparison completely false. Wow, wow, wow. You wonder why BBC's reporting is often anti-Israel, anti-Jewish. All right, our buddy Charles in Lancaster, Texas, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, so I have a question. It's sort of in regards to how Paul used the term Messiah and how he applied it to Jesus. I've listened to a lot of your teaching, especially you several times, you know, it's the importance of the fact that the messianic hope in Israel developed spiritually. And so in that, at the time, you know, the New Testament was written, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the concept of the Messiah was not quite developed yet, or had not really arisen, especially not to the sense where it's at now. So, you know, the term Messiah, could you, like, give us some clarity first on what that word means, just for the sake of the listeners? And then, you know, because, you know, I've heard you mention, you know, hey, Jesus, you know, when people see his name, they think, you know, he's the son of Mr. and Mrs. Christ. You know, so right. because of that concept not being fully developed, I wanted to ask you what, you know, how do you see Paul using the term Messiah and applying it to Jesus? Obviously, you know, he's convinced as a witness that Jesus was the Messiah, but... You know,
let me just jump in because I got a break coming up.
Okay.
No, there's no question whatsoever, although the concept developed gradually in ancient Israel. In the first centuries before Jesus came into the world, there was clear talk about the Messiah. There was clear expectation of the Messiah. How widespread could be debated, but without question, the idea of the Messiah that was known in Jewish circles, that was known in Samaritan circles, in the first century and before, there was debate about what he would do, and would he be a great king, or would he be a great teacher, or would there be two messianic figures? But that was fully, you know, the Messiah descended from David, the Messiah of Israel, and the Messiah descended from Aaron. But no question whatsoever that it was absolutely established, the Messiah. The question was what Jesus meant when he identified himself as Son of God or Son of Man. Those are debated. But the Messiah, the anointed king who would rule and reign, who would deliver Israel, maybe teach, maybe other things, That was established. We'll be right back. More to come.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I just want to finish up this thoroughly Jewish question with my thoroughly Jewish answer. So, Charles, again, there was no ambiguity in many Jewish circles about there being a messianic figure, a deliverer. Would he be of supernatural proportions? You know, a greatly exalted man, some type of an angelic deliverer, or just a mere mortal. You might have had some disagreement in those things or exactly what role he would have. But the idea of the Messiah existing in first century Jewish thought, absolutely clearly there, and at times before that as well. In God's wisdom, the concept of Messiah, I believe, was developed gradually in the hearts and minds of the people of Israel. So when exactly that full concept emerged is a matter of scholarly debate. But in the Greek world, unless you were a Jewish person, a Christos or HaKristos did not have particular meaning to you. It was the Greek way of saying the anointed one, HaMashiach, the anointed one. So in and of itself, in Greek, it didn't really have significance. It didn't mean Lord. It didn't mean master. It didn't mean savior. And being an anointed one had no meaning. In other words, that's not how you thought of a king. Right. That's not how you thought of a leader. So in a short period of time, as Paul was writing to Gentile believers and writing about Jesus Christos, writing about this Jesus Christ, or Jesus HaKristos, or HaKristos Jesus, the Messiah Jesus, right, that for the Greek readers, that at a certain point, it was very easily a name for them. Jesus Christ, just as it's become to most people through the centuries. That's because Christos, Christ, had no meaning. But to Greek-speaking Jews, Christos had the meaning of anointed, anointed one, hence Messiah, and that was much more readily understood.
Right, okay. That's great. I appreciate you clearing that up. And yes, you did teach that, you know, the concept of Messiah. I do remember you teaching that, you know, it came from the Davidic, the concept of the Davidic king, you know, that's where it arose from. I remember you mentioning that Messiah just simply means an anointed one. So, yeah, it's interesting, you know, that Messiah is first used as in the application to the priests. You know, a lot of people kind of...
Right, priests first, the anointed high priest, and then for King Saul, the first king was called anointed one because they would anoint him. They would be anointed for that. And then the prophets were anointed by the Spirit. They were anointed ones in a different way. But the kings and priests would have the literal anointing oil put on them, hence anointed one. And then ultimately, out of the different anointed ones emerges the anointed one. And where is that anointed one that we long for, that redeemer, that deliverer, that messianic king? Hey, thank you for the call. Always good to talk with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Okay. Something else that is bothering me, and I don't want to talk to you about it today on the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you want to get blocked quickly, if you're posting on our Facebook page or tweeting me or posting on our YouTube page, you want to get blocked quickly, use profanity. Any of our team sees that, you'll immediately be blocked. You say, well, that's just the way I talk. Fine, but it's inappropriate. We don't want other people to be exposed to it. They think they're going to a site that is for believers, and non-believers are there. They're going to communicate in a way that's civil. Also, if you engage in personal insult about others, I don't mind the insults personally, but we even have to do it when you personally insult me. But if you're going to engage in ugly personal insult, we just don't want it. We will not allow the conversation to be dragged down. But here's another way to get blocked quickly. Engage in anti-Semitic hate speech. Engage in ugly anti-Semitic hate speech, and you will get blocked quickly. I'm looking at posts by one individual. Somehow, he's able to post again after this, not quite sure how, but now officially blocked, so his post would be hidden. Speaking of Jewish people, he speaks of all their lies. Oh, and this is in the name of Jesus. He's doing it in the name of Jesus. He speaks of all their lies and warmongering, never-ending greed fest, being sickening. The Protocols of Zion, actually called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a complete forged document with this alleged scheme of the Jews. The Jews are going to take over the world. Oh, yeah. I guess they took over the world as the Nazis were killing them, too. I guess they took over the world as they were scattered, suffering throughout the nations. Oh, yeah. The Protocols of Zion in action. Wolf in sheep's clothing aren't so hidden. Wolves will be dealt with. Gypsy people. And this is a supposed Christian. And then I just realized today, same person posting this. The Jews won't allow debate about the so-called gas chambers. Buddy, when 6 million of our people were slaughtered by the Nazis, when it's documented, when there's massive eyewitness testimony from the survivors, from the people that went into the camps afterwards, now even more documentary evidence as far as how widespread the concentration camps were throughout Germany and other nations, and how impossible it would have been for so many people to not know what was going on at all. That's not going to be debated. That's not going to be debated. When 1.5 million children were slaughtered, that's not going to be debated. When children were sometimes just thrown into a burning pit where the adults were shot and then thrown into the pit, and then they just threw the babies in because they didn't want to waste a bullet on them, that's not going to be debated. When there are people who saw it with their own eyes, when they're Nazis who in their old age confess to all these things and just want to get it off their chest, that's not going to be debated, buddy. The Jew here forces his attitude and lies onto all. Oh, so in other words, when we post something, when we post an Israeli journalist asking if a Palestinian man wants his son to grow up and die killing Jews, that is the Jew here forcing his attitudes onto all. And now he's got a YouTube link about Auschwitz. Nice try. Listen to this nut making it about what is worse. There were no gas chambers. I will debate Dr. Brown anytime, anywhere. I'm not your father's gullible goy. Ah, ha, ha. Let me tell you something, buddy. You're deceived. You may not be a gullible Gentile, but you're a deeply deceived Gentile, a deluded Gentile. Oh, let me take it one step further. You're totally gullible to believe the trash, to believe the lies, to believe one of the ugliest lies in human history, that there were no gas chambers. Even someone like Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who wrote his doctoral dissertation for an Arab Muslim institute, saying that the numbers were exaggerated. The Holocaust happened, but the numbers were exaggerated. Even he didn't say no gas chambers, although his thesis was still ugly and despicable. But someone that talks like you, no, you're not going to debate me. That's never going to happen. I'm not going to debate someone that speaks trash, that speaks satanic lies, that makes a mockery of the deaths of millions of people. You want to get blocked in a hurry, just spout garbage like that. And you are not someone that is going to have the liberty of using our platform, our websites, our YouTube channels, our Facebook pages. You're not going to have the liberty of spreading your trash through us. Just wanted to get that off of my heart. 866-348-7884. Hey, listen to what Israeli Arab journalist Khaled Abu Tomet writes. The Palestinian Authority, PA leadership, continues to give false hope to Palestinians regarding, quote, the right of return to their former villages and towns in Israel, as do the leaderships of most Arab countries. This is what the Arab and Palestinian leaders have been doing since the establishment of Israel in 1948, and why millions of Palestinians continue to live in refugee camps throughout the West Bank, Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. I've asked this question over and over and over and over again. I'll ask it once again. Why are Palestinians in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, Gaza Strip, why are they living in refugee camps? Hamas leadership, government, They're not to be living in refugee camps. There's enough money. Stop building the terror tunnels. Hamas leadership. Stop putting the money into rockets to kill Jews. Stop doing that. Stop building the terror tunnels. Take the money you're getting and put it into infrastructure and build the buildings, build the schools, and build the hospitals. Why are Palestinians among their fellow Arabs in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan living in refugee camps? Why aren't they absorbed? Well, that would mess up the demographics. That would, in other words, you can't absorb them because you don't want them. And you can't absorb them because then it takes away a lot of the stench that goes against Israel. He said, instead of helping the refugees and encouraging them to move on with their lives, Arab and Palestinian leaders continue to ask them to stay where they are because they are told they will return to the homes of their grandfathers and great-grandfathers inside Israel. Bogus, another lie, to mistreat these people loved by God and for whom Jesus died. Another lie they're being told.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I've got a stack of things here on my desk. Do I want to get through any more of them? Let's just see. Western European Muslim jihad against the Jews. Less Christian U.S. scene disturbing on Israel. Oh. Let's look at that. We talked about a Pew Forum report that indicated that the decline of Christianity in America continues, although over 70% of Americans profess to be Christians, but that a good amount are dropping out, and they say that they have no religious affiliation, and more are professing atheism and agnosticism. But in point of fact, evangelical numbers have grown. As a percentage of the population, down a little bit, but actually have grown from 2007-2014 by a couple of million, whereas the mainline Protestant churches and Catholic churches, which in America tend to be fairly liberal, along with the mainline Protestant churches, which are liberal, they've declined by 5 million, by more than that combined. So the liberal churches are on the decline. The conservative churches are growing, and that's the case pretty much around the world. So I have an article. If you haven't read it, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and click on latest article, and you'll see it, why the conservative churches are growing. But there are concerns in Jewish circles about what this means as far as America's relationship to Israel. There would be far less support for Israel if America was more and more atheistic and agnostic. There would be less solidarity with Israel. Not because atheists hate Jews. In fact, there's a higher percentage of Jewish atheists than of the general population. At least the last survey I read, that was the case. But it's understood that there are more Christian reasons for solidarity with Israel than atheists would have. And us believing that this is something having to do with God and his promises. Yes, we want to see justice for all people, but we believe that it is God who's brought the Jewish people back to the land. So Robert Goldblum, writing in the Jewish Week yesterday, said, with the religious landscape in America in the throes of dramatic change, it is less Christian, more Muslim, Islamic population remains tiny still, and far more, this is accurately stated, well, it's stated, I just want to fine-tune it, far more religiously unaffiliated than it was just 7 years ago. The Jewish community has perhaps surprisingly remained stable. Now, one reason I'd say it's remained stable is because of the increase of Orthodox Jews who are having larger families. That's why I would say it has remained stable. Of all faith groups, Judaism has among the highest rates of retention, a fact that runs counter to a widespread trend of people leaving the religion of their childhood in the search for spiritual connection. 75% of Jews continue to identify with their childhood faith. Only Hindus and Muslims have higher retention rates than Jews. Still, I would say that that's a point of concern, that it's 75% continue in the faith of their parents. That means 25% do not. But it says here, what could be a troubling, and what could be a troubling sign for the Jewish community if the trend holds, evangelicals, traditionally some of the Jewish state's fiercest supporters, fell by one percentage point from 26% to 25% of all American Christians. Now, they did grow by 2 million, but as a percentage of overall Christians, the number dropped over a seven-year period from 26% to 25%. So here is a Jewish columnist recognizing that evangelical support for Israel is critical, and that as the number of evangelicals declines, if it declines, that could mean and would logically mean a decline in support for Israel. America's Catholic population, another source of strong support for Israel, is also on the decline, having fallen by 3.1% from 2007 to 2014, from 24% of all Christians to 21%. Protestants have been on decline for several decades. In the new study, they declined both in share and absolute numbers. Catholics in the new study are declining in share and absolute numbers, but evangelicals have grown in absolute numbers. Still very interesting. What is it that causes America to stand with Israel? What is it? Is it all history? Is there some deeper spiritual connection? What are the reasons for these things? Fair questions to ask, but I would say without a vibrant Christian witness, that support for Israel would be less in America than it currently is. And again, the younger generation must be touched. The younger generation must be touched so as to stand together with Israel and Jewish people. Hey, how would you like to partner with me? Now that I'm saying that, I'm flying over to Israel, God willing, the end of June, to spend 4 or 5 days there, to speak at a key Messianic congregation in Tel Aviv, to do a special seminar on answering the rabbis for a number of affiliated congregations, and then together with One King Conference in Jerusalem, to speak to young people, young leaders, younger believers, the younger generation, as to the fundamental importance of Israel, the importance of Israel in terms of why Christians should stand with Israel, why this is a spiritual matter. It doesn't mean you stand against the Palestinians. If you're pro-Israel, in my book, you're pro-Palestinian, because if you have Israel's best interest in mind, you'll have the Palestinians' best interest in mind, and ultimately it's the only way that there can be a godly solution. But these meetings could be very critical. We must touch the younger generation. Now, my expenses are paid in going there. I don't need to raise funds to do that. However, this takes us away from other things that we could be doing in the States that help support our ministry work. And I will be on the front line serving there in Israel. If you'd like to help support that, if you would like to sow into that with your one-time gift that will help hold my hands up there in Israel in the midst of the travel, the rigor of the travel, we'll be broadcasting live from Israel. I'm just trying to think of schedule when I travel, when I'm there. I think at least one day we broadcast live from Israel, which is always a special joy when we are able to do that. But bottom line, it's going to be a very important trip. And if you can help with us, if you could stand with us, that would be great. To support us with a one-time gift of any amount, call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978. That will help with funds in our U.S. operation and all of our radio outreach and other work we do. That will help hold our hands up here while I am serving in Israel. 1-800-278-9978. If you're a pastor listening, does your church support Jewish outreach? Does your church support reaching the lost sheep of the house of Israel? Well, why not? Put us on your mission budget. Add us in, and we will be your arm. We will be your voice reaching Jewish people in Yeshua's name. To give online, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. That's Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Just click on Donate. When you're there, find out as well about becoming a monthly torchbearer. That is the backbone of this ministry. Those who help us on a monthly basis, part of our support team. To find out about that and all the benefits that will come your way, our thank you to you, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on Donate and Monthly Support. My bottom line today, it remains important on the Lord's heart that Christians stand together with Israel and support the lost sheep of the house of Israel and reach out to the Jewish people in Yeshua's name.